Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. Consuming excessive amounts of alcohol isn't safe for any person at any age. Usually, though, we associate binge drinking with young adults, but those statistics are changing. Now studies show older adults are starting to get into binge drinking habits, and it is particularly dangerous for older adults. According to a new study published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, about 1 in 10 older adults is considered a binge drinker. Dr. George F. Koob is the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Dr. Koob, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's start here. We're going to start this conversation with a definition of binge drinking. What is it?
So binge drinking is defined as reaching a blood alcohol level of 0.08 gram percent, which is the legal limit in the United States, in 2 hours. And we usually attain that as males with 5 drinks in 2 hours, standard drinks, and with females, 4 drinks in 2 hours.
And would this be without any food, just drinking, or do you not even consider that an equation?
Well, it would probably be with minimal amounts of food. Food will slow the absorption of alcohol, so you will get a blunted blood alcohol level if you have a full stomach.
Why is binge drinking then more dangerous than regular drinking? What are the negative health effects?
Well, the negative health effects are basically being pretty severely intoxicated, which leads to falls, problems with balance. You shouldn't be driving an automobile or even a tractor, for that matter. There are interactions with medications, since most, about 4 out of 5 elderly individuals are taking some medication that can interact with alcohol. And, you know, I like to give this little pharmacology speech when it comes to alcohol and any other sedative type drug, including opioids, 2 + 2 = 5. So alcohol effects become synergistic or more than additive when combined with other drugs. And that is one of the big things that's really important. And then finally, you know, as we age, our functions decline, like working memory, cognitive functions, ability to make decisions, executive functions that in that domain. And, you know, alcohol doesn't facilitate or help any of that and probably makes most of those declines worse. So you have additive effects with aging. And there's been some recent studies that have come out supporting this hypothesis.
I mentioned earlier a study in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, and I'll point out that you were not part of this study, but the study found that 1 in 10 older adults is considered a binge drinker. Does that surprise you? 1 in 10?
No, not at all. I mean, we've been following this for some time, and basically that's a number that's been creeping up over time. I think it's closer to 11.5% at this point who binge drink in the 65 and older age group.
And why is this happening?
Well, I think part of it is the cohort effect, possibly. The baby boomers, of which I'm a member, are aging. And I think they're bringing with them the demography of culture and also number. So that's part of it. I think part of it has to do with Angus Deaton and Ann Case have been describing as the death of despair, which is the issues surrounding increased mortality in the United States, which has probably contributes to the problems that we have with overdoses with alcohol, overdoses with opioids. There's significant stress that's involved in these deaths of despair. And I think there's a significant amount of stress in society that goes somewhat unrecognized. And I think, again, maybe baby boomers are more likely to use alcohol to cope with that kind of stress.
And one thing that you didn't bring up, but I bet would be in this group would be loneliness, as older adults find their friends and family, you know, leaving them alone, then that could lead to someone doing something like this on your own. So we're talking about older adults who have binge drinking problems. And earlier you mentioned some health problems that are associated with binge drinking. But what is this specific for the older adults who are binge drinkers?
Well, I don't know that there's anything specific. I mean, alcohol use disorder is a spinoff of often of binge drinking and excessive drinking, and that brings with it everything from cirrhosis of the liver to impairments in social and occupational functioning. Individuals who are not getting along with family members, not if they're still working or not getting along, and maybe being impaired in their work environment, even if it's philanthropic exercises because they're retired, that can be impaired. So you have all the consequences of an alcohol use disorder that are increase with increased excessive drinking. Then there's the cognitive effects. There's pretty good evidence from imaging studies that there's a larger decline in not only in cognitive function, but in also in brain cells in the frontal cortex. We lose those cells as we get older, but alcohol seems to facilitate that loss. And so it ranges from everything from neurological effects all the way to corrupting your liver.
We're talking to Dr. George F. Koob, the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and the topic is binge drinking in older adults. And Dr. Koob, when we talk about definitions, would you consider binge drinking and someone who does binge drink an alcoholic? Are they the same things?
No. The alcoholic has kind of fallen off the approved radar screen simply because of its pejorative nature. But what we used to call an alcoholic would be somebody who meets the criterions of moderate to severe alcohol use disorder. And that would mean getting, anywhere from 4 to 5 of the symptoms in their 11 symptoms. Generally, that would probably be the closest match in terminology. Binge drinking does not necessarily mean someone's meeting the criterion for an alcohol use disorder, but it certainly means that they're likely to in the future.
If you are at wherever you're listening to this, how would you describe how someone knows themselves whether they have a problem?
So there is a really good question. There is a 10-item questionnaire called the Short Michigan Alcohol Screening Test, and they ask some of these kind of questions when talking to others. Do you ever underestimate how much you drink after a few drinks? Have you sometimes not eaten or been able to skip a meal because you didn't feel hungry? Does having a few drinks help decrease your shakiness or tremors? Does alcohol sometimes make it hard for you to remember parts of the day or night? Do you usually take a drink to relax or calm your nerves? Do you take a drink to take your mind off problems? Have you ever increased drinking, experienced a loss in life? Was your doctor ever concerned about your drinking? And the one you mentioned, when you feel lonely, does having a drink help? And so those are some of the things I think people can use as an index. I'm sure this is on the internet if you want to look it up. It's called the Short Michigan Alcohol Screening Test, geriatric version.
And for someone who thinks they might know a binge drinker as an older adult, might be harder to spot the signs. What would they look for?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. You know, changes in behavior are a good index that something's not right. People skipping meals, but also slurring their speech, maybe late at night when they're on the phone, when you call your loved one just to check in, but they could be also, these runs of irritability and maybe even unpleasantness on the phone, but also you catch a few words that are slurred. Those are some of the early signs.
But we also know folks are really good at hiding things when it comes to this.
Absolutely. They're the best at some of this. So, you have to, if you're doing their receipts for their purchases for health products, you might want to check if it's like in California where they sell a liquor in a supermarket, you might want to check to make sure that a bottle of bourbon hasn't gotten in there with the aspirin. I mean, those are the kind of things that you kind of need to look for if you're. But I think the first signs would be behavioral ones, where you see something different about mom or dad, you know.
Mm-hmm. If someone has not been binge drinking in the past, in younger years, at what age do they start to see people pick up this habit?
That's a question. I'm not sure we know the answer of exactly what age this binge drinking will kick in. It can kick in at any age, you know, it's not a given by any stretch. Generally, 20 to 30-year-olds are binge drinking more than anyone else, and so that's the age where it begins. One positive fact in the horizon is that we actually have been seeing a straight line decrease in underage drinking in the United States and a straight line decrease in binge drinking that's underage. But when you get to 21, which is the legal limit, then you start to see this huge upswing in binge drinking.
And has that changed at all, or does that keep escalating in that age of 20 to 30?
I think that's been going up as well in that age group in the binge drinking. And that is something where we're trying to put some energy in, trying to understand what's driving that and what prevention measures we can employ.
And part of this discussion, I think, is approach too. Europeans approach and think of alcohol differently than Americans. Could that be part of the issue here?
Well, actually, I'm not sure that's true anymore. I think historically, yes, the way alcohol was ingested by individuals in rural communities was, you know, the bottle of wine at dinner and associated with meals. But, you know, I've talked to officials. I have a pretty active relationship with colleagues in France, and I've been told that they have a binge drinking issue with young people in France, just like we do. And there's certainly the same in the United Kingdom, where alcohol problems are really prominent right now. They don't have a major opioid crisis, although apparently there's been a pickup in heroin problems in Scotland recently, but they have a huge alcohol problem in the UK.
Hmm. Well, when people binge drink, do they do it once a week, twice a week? Are there patterns here?
It's highly variable as to when people, you know, the pattern that they engage in. I mean, typically someone binge drinks on the weekends.
It's a social
initially.
Thing?
It's a social thing. You know, we did a film with HBO a while back, just a couple of years ago, called Risky Drinking. And the first vignette there describes kind of young people engaged in this kind of binge drinking. And they might go out in an evening with, you know, saying, well, they're going to have three or four drinks. But when you actually chart their intake, and that's what HBO did on this documentary, you see they're only maybe two-thirds of the way through the evening, they're already at 10 to 15 drinks. So that's how it kind of starts.
Wow.
And, you know, it's partying and young people in their 20s and 30s. And then that becomes, you know, there's a habit aspect to it and a coping part that comes with it. So there's a, you know, there's the memory that, well, I'm going to go get blitzed and that'll drown out all the problems that I'm currently having at work or something of that nature.
And so the differences in the reasons for binge drinking could be differences in age as well, and where these people are in their life is what issues would drive them to do this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a really good point. So when you're young, it could be partying and social engagement and peer pressure and being part of the group. And when you're older, it could be more to deal with stress, coping responses. And that's where it gets dangerous, because that's where, in my view, you start to cross the line into, you know, the moderate and severe alcohol use disorder.
Dr. George F. Koob, director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Interesting conversation on binge drinking in older adults. Thank you, Dr. Koob.
You're most welcome.
We're going to take a break now. Yes, thank you. We're going to take a break now. Listeners, you can join the conversation. We hope you do. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. Colorectal cancer rates in adults over 50 have been falling dramatically since the mid-1980s. The decline is thanks in large part to better screening. But according to a new study published in the journal JAMA Network Open, colorectal cancer rates are increasing among adults in their 20s and 30s. Dr. Robin Mendelson is a gastroenterologist and co-director of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center for Young Onset Colorectal Cancer in New York City. Welcome, Dr. Mendelson.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start first with the colon. What does it do? Yeah. Let's describe it. Why do we need it?
So your colon is the organ that helps you have bowel movement. Most people take it for granted until it doesn't work. Its main goal is to resorb water so you can have nice daily form bowel movement.
And colorectal cancer and colon cancer, are they the same thing, a slight difference?
So they're just different anatomically. So the rectum is considered the last part of the colon. So it's the last part of the colon right before the bowel movements come out. So when we talk about colon cancer or colorectal cancer, we usually use them synonymously. But when we're being technical, the rectum is actually the bottom of the colon.
Do we know any causes for colorectal cancer?
So in general, there are multiple known risk factors. Number one is genetic. So if you have a family history of colon cancer or rectal cancer. Another is inflammatory bowel disease, which is also known as Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. And these are diseases where there is chronic inflammation of the colon, which over time can lead to colon cancer. And then there's some environmental factors. We know that it's associated with obesity, smoking tobacco, drinking alcohol, diabetes, and possible other chronic inflammatory diseases.
And as we mentioned, this has been decreasing in older adults because we've increased screenings, one since the 80s, 90s?
Yep. So we've seen a nice decrease in those over 50 since the 1990s. And though it's likely due to multiple things such as modifications of the risk factors that I just talked about and better treatment, the majority has really been attributed to screening for colorectal cancer, most notably doing colonoscopies and removal of precancerous polyps. Because we do know that colon cancers do come from polyps, which are precancerous growths in the colon. And we think that in the general population, the time between a polyp becoming cancer is about 10 years.
That's why every 10 years we're supposed to have a screening, right?
Exactly, if it's normal. If they find polyps, they do it more frequently. Because if you do make polyps, you're at risk for making more, and that's why we do it more frequently.
We are seeing a higher rate of cancer in the colon in younger populations. Any idea why this is happening?
I wish I knew the answer to that. We are seeing this increase. And when you look back, it's actually been reported in the literature since the late 1990s, mostly in the surgical literature. And then in 2010-ish, we really started to notice this increase. It's been increasing about 1 to 2% per year. And in young adults, it's actually more common to see it in the rectum, in the lower part of the colon. We've been trying to figure out why. It was one of the main research goals of why we opened the center last March. There are speculations that it might be due to obesity, but that's probably not the whole answer. Anecdotally, most of the patients that we've been seeing are healthy, young, with absolutely none of those known risk factors that I went over.
And so there would be nothing that would contribute to this, and then all of a sudden it surfaces.
We're trying to figure that out. There doesn't seem to be one answer to that. There are multiple hypotheses. One of the hottest topics now is the microbiome, which is all of the bacteria and organisms that live in your colon that can change based on diet, antibiotics, different medications, environmental changes. And the question is, has it been a change in the microbiome that has led to this increase, and that is something that we're looking into. We are looking at all of our young patients and asking questions about diet, medications, exposures, really trying to get to the bottom of this. But right now, there really is no known reason for this increase.
And I would think that because it's not the norm to have these testings done every 10 years, or if you're more susceptible, every 5, that we don't do these screenings in young people, that they could be at a higher risk?
So it doesn't seem to be that it's because of the not screening. And, you know, ideally people, you know, we would screen everybody, but we just don't have the resources to do that. And in addition, even though these numbers are increasing, the numbers are still small. So the goal is to really try to figure out a risk group that we could initiate screening earlier on. So we do screening earlier on people who have a family history of colon cancer or a family history of advanced polyps, meaning more aggressive polyps. And we do screening earlier on those patients with inflammatory bowel disease. But we just don't know which groups to target to start screening earlier. So that's something that we're looking into to try to figure out who would benefit from the screening and when to start.
What are some early signs and symptoms of colon cancer, no matter what age?
So most of the time when it's early, it's actually no symptoms. And that's why we do colon cancer screening, because the goal is to detect these cancers early. When we detect them early, they have an over 90% survival rate.
Wow.
So it's, so if we can find these early, so we do colonoscopies and other screening tests, not only to find these polyps and remove them to prevent cancer, but also if we are to find a cancer, to find it early, because early detection is key. And a lot of the times when it's early, there are actually no symptoms whatsoever. But unfortunately, when it does become more advanced, people do have symptoms. When we looked back at our young patients, the most common presenting symptom was rectal bleeding. Also, other symptoms are change in bowel habits, new constipation, diarrhea, abdominal bloating, abdominal pain. And any of these symptoms, if they are persistent, should really be checked out by a physician, especially because now we don't know who to screen early. So getting the news out there that this is a phenomenon, and to increase awareness so that people can be evaluated and hopefully caught at a treatable stage.
The bad part is a lot of those signs and symptoms you spoke about could be many different things.
Absolutely. So the majority of people with rectal bleeding don't usually have colon cancer. It is usually something else. But in the chance that it is, it's important to talk to a physician and decide if they should get further testing.
We're talking with Dr. Robin Mendelson. She's a gastroenterologist and co-director of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center for Young Onset Colorectal Cancer. What questions should patients be asking their doctor? And I know a lot of people are embarrassed to bring this up, but it's, if you don't talk to your doctor, you don't find out anything.
Absolutely. So a few things. It's extremely important to know your family history. A lot of people don't like to talk about cancer, don't like to tell about their other diseases, but it's very important to know if you have a family history of colon cancer, because we would recommend starting screening earlier. And then it's important to just, you know, tell your doctor about any new symptoms or any persistent symptoms. And like I said, the majority of the time it is unlikely to be cancer, but because of this increase, you know, we used to say if you were young, you don't have colon cancer, and unfortunately, that's not the case anymore. So it's very important to bring up these symptoms, and when we talk to patients, a lot of them did bring up symptoms with multiple physicians, and because they were young and otherwise healthy, cancer was not thought to be a possible cause, and so it's very important to advocate for yourself and really discuss it with your physician.
And as you said, this is becoming more known in the medical community, so that when you do go into the doctor, a light bulb might go on, whereas it didn't before, to possibly look at colon cancer.
Absolutely. And that's one of, you know, our goals is, like I said, especially because we don't know who to screen, is really to increase awareness, because a lot of these patients are not necessarily coming to a gastroenterologist first. They're being seen in urgent cares or the emergency room, primary care physicians, OBGYNs. And so one of our goals is really to get it out there so that when they're seeing the first point contact, this raises a light bulb, and therefore they can be referred for further workup if seemed necessary.
How does diet factor into this discussion and a healthy colon?
Yes. So, you know, there are some data to show that eating red meat and processed meat is associated with colon cancer. What we recommend is really to eat a healthy diet, plant-based diet, where about two-thirds of your plate are fruits and vegetables and one-third or less are lean animal protein. Of course, you know, we want people to enjoy life and everything is okay in moderation, but really to limit the red meat and processed meat because that has been associated with colon cancer.
What do you mean by processed meat?
So like bacon, ham, salami, that sort of thing, deli meats, anything that comes in a can, those are all considered processed meats.
So we've talked about diet. Other preventative measures that everyone should consider?
So, you know, of course, diet, exercise. If, you know, you are to be diagnosed with colorectal cancer, you undergo multiple treatments and surgery. And so you really want to make sure your heart and your lungs are as healthy as they could possibly be if that happens. So keeping those healthy is important. And staying on top of screening, because as we've shown, you know, screening can really save lives. So knowing what your risk factors are and when you should get screened is really key.
Dr. Mendelsohn, you are looking at the onset of colorectal cancer in young people. So for millennials, I mean, is this another reason why it is important for somebody like you to be super concentrated on this population?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's important for people to be in tune with their symptoms and talk to their doctors. When people that are diagnosed are working hard to really come to the bottom of this and try to understand not only why is this happening, but the appropriate treatments for them. You know, it's different when a 20-year-old versus a 70-year-old is diagnosed. We're hoping to, you know, get them through treatment and then hopefully have another, you know, 60, 70 years to live. So trying to figure out the best treatments for them and everything like that, and that's what we're working on.
You've been doing this since March, you said? So the center has been open for a real long time, right?
So we opened the center last March, and we have already enrolled over 500 patients. Unfortunately, we're busy, but we're working really hard to try to not only give these people a coordinated care, because that was the first main goal of the center, you know, to really meet their clinical needs, working with fertility and nutrition and integrative medicine, to really give them the coordinated care that they need to get them through treatment. And then the research part of it, like I said, to first things are really to try to figure out what's going on.
And we've talked about young onset. What ages are we talking about, basically?
So the biggest increase has actually been seen in the 20 to 29 group, but it has been increasing in all groups. But the biggest increase has actually been in the youngest group.
And what made you decide to do this specifically for young people? What were you finding that you thought it might be necessary to concentrate on this population?
Well, the first was the ongoing increase. You know, at first there were questions. This is just that we are doing more colonoscopies or we're finding this more often, and it became more and more evident that that wasn't the case, that the incidence was really increasing. And so we wanted to figure that out. The other thing was just talking to these patients and realizing that, you know, their clinical needs weren't being met. They were coming in, you know, in their 20s, you know, running marathons the week before, and then suddenly with this, you know, change in life diagnosis, and really trying to give them the things that they need. They, you know, they don't have wills. They weren't thinking about children, and all of these things need to be decided very quickly before you start treatment, which you want to start as quickly as possible. And so talking to them and and realizing that we were missing a lot of components. We were, you know, treating cancer very well, but missing some of the psychosocial components and other really necessary components to get them through their treatment. And so that's why we really wanted to start the center.
Very, very important. And also, once you have seen some of these patients, because by the time you see them, are they more advanced? Are some of these cases aren't as easy to have good outcomes?
Right. So because most of them do present with symptoms, like we talked about, the majority do present at later stages. They do have, they're not found early, so their rates of success can be a little bit lower. But when we look back at our data, we actually found that our young patients actually do better than the older patients, which is a little bit different than the national SEER data, and something that we're looking into to try to figure out. When we look at their tumors, when we analyze them, they seem to be very similar to those over 50. So we're not sure exactly what's going on, but again, something that we're looking into.
Well, it sounds like you have your hands full and you're doing good work.
We're trying.
Dr. Robin Mendelson, gastroenterologist and co-director of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center for Young Onset Colorectal Cancer. Thank you, Dr. Mendelson.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. Researchers estimate that around 32 million Americans have food allergies. That includes 5.6 million children under age 18. That's about two kids in every classroom. And according to the Centers for Disease Control, food allergies in children are on the rise. And with students heading back to school soon, food allergy prevention and awareness become that much more important. Dr. Princess Obagu is the Director of Allergy and Immunology at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. She joins me in the studio. Hi, Doctor.
Hi, good afternoon.
Thank you for being here for this discussion and something that we've said seems to be skyrocketing in the number of children that are diagnosed. Let's start with some basic information. What does science tell us about the cause of food allergies?
So in general, we know that allergy is genetic. If you have parents who are allergic, you're likely to have children who are allergic. But this means that they could have food allergy, they could have environmental allergy, they could have asthma. So it all sort of falls in the same genetic area, and we know that you have an increased likelihood. And we've certainly seen a tremendous rise in food allergy and allergy in general over the years.
So we have seen the prevalence of food allergies higher today than in the past.
We have. I mean, we estimate right now that about 6 to 9% of children have food allergy, about 2 to 3% of adults have food allergy. Of course, those numbers will change as these children grow up and we have more adults with food allergy. But it's, you know, a lot of people cannot recall having a peanut-free classroom when they were in school, but it's so common now in daycares and elementary schools because we've seen this rise. We don't really know the answer, but there are a lot of hypotheses on why we have more allergy in general, ranging from hygiene hypothesis, which a lot of people have heard of, that it's a cleaner society, so it skews our immune system more towards allergy. There are plenty of other hypotheses, but the answer is we don't really know 100% why, but we've certainly seen this tremendous increase in prevalence, especially in the children.
You mentioned environmental, and I think that's interesting. I mean, some people will simply say, well, you need to go play in the dirt. So what do you mean by environmental and how that might affect allergies in young people?
Well, so we see more environmental allergies in general. So we're seeing a lot more allergic rhinitis, allergies to pollen, animal dander, dust mite, mold. So not only are we seeing food allergies, but we're seeing more environmental allergy to these really common exposures that your immune system really shouldn't be reacting to, but is.
What does happen to the body during an allergic reaction?
So when you have allergic reaction, your body actually makes antibodies against whatever it is that you're allergic to. So it could be to pollen, it could be to cat or dog, it could be to peanut or shrimp. And whenever you are exposed, either through inhalation or contact or ingestion, eating, you have a series of immune reactions that trigger your cells to release histamine, and you have really what we would consider a classic allergic reaction. But it's all based on developing these antibodies, allergic antibodies to these substances, which are really should be harmless substances for us, but somehow our immune systems develop this reaction and we see allergy.
So the body at some point feels like something's invading it and it's fighting back?
Basically. We always say allergy is an abnormal immune reaction. So your body really should see these common allergens and not really react to them. But we've seen that over time our immune systems have developed this propensity to react to these, and we're seeing, you know, obviously a lot more food allergy, but also environmental allergy, also asthma, which is oftentimes triggered by environmental allergies or environmental exposures. And all of these things are so important when kids are going back to school. So not only food allergies, but increase in asthma, exacerbations, reactions. So we are thinking of all of these things as allergists when a child is going back to school, because these are some of the things that need to be, parents need to be aware of, care providers need to be aware of, and the schools.
School nurses have their hands full now, don't they?
They absolutely have their hands full.
Are allergies and asthma tied together in most cases?
They are. In most cases, they are. You do have some instances where someone may have asthma and they don't have detectable environmental allergies. But in the large majority of patients, allergies and asthma are tied together. And we see this very commonly with children.
As parents, how do they start then to introduce food to their child to see maybe what they may or may not be allergic to? And when they're young, you try to give them all kinds of – expose them to all kinds of tastes. What should parents look for?
So that's a great question, and that answer has changed dramatically over the last 10 years. So 10 years ago, if you asked me this question, we would have said you want to delay introduction of certain foods like egg, like milk, and like – peanuts.
Common things.
And we've learned with major studies over time that that's not the right approach. Your immune system actually does need to see them quite early so that it develops tolerance rather than allergy. And so I know we've discussed this on a prior show, but we know through studies with early peanut introduction that that can actually prevent allergy. And so that is really important. So I think for parents, the most key thing right now, because there is still some misinformation out there and everyone's situation is so unique, that it is so important. See a board certified allergist immunologist. Talk about your concern. When your child is young, if there's a family history of an older sibling with allergies, that might change things. So you want to talk to the allergist and get really good guidance. But for the most part, for most patients, what we will say is we want to introduce these things early that we may not have before, because we know that this is one of the things we can do to actually prevent allergies.
A parent then gives a child food and they start to have a reaction, or they think it's a reaction. What are signs and symptoms of an allergic reaction to a food?
So signs and symptoms are ingesting the food and having itching, swelling, hives, shortness of breath, or anaphylaxis, which could be a life-threatening allergic reaction. So
does that usually happen the first time someone, or do you build up to that? Does the body build up to
it? It can happen the first time. So I can say that with my own child, the first time he had a cashew, he had anaphylaxis to it. So not only am I an allergist, but I understand it from the other side because I have children with food allergy, but it can happen the first time. So you want to look for these signs. So it can be, you know, a little bit of itching, a little bit of rash, or it can be as severe as anaphylaxis where they are pale with low blood pressure, difficulty breathing, those sorts of things. If there is concern for food allergy, obviously in an emergency, you would call 911 and have the child evaluated immediately. But if there, you know, is a low level concern that every time this child eats this food, I think there might be a bit of a reaction, this is when it needs to be checked out. And so going to the allergist and evaluating for those concerns is paramount, especially before a child leaves the home and goes to school. The parent really want to know, really should know what they're allergic to.
Can kids grow out of these allergies?
Kids can. They absolutely can. So we know that certain allergies are a little bit easier for the immune system in many cases to grow out of. So that could include milk or wheat. We know some are much more difficult to grow out of, and those include the nuts like peanuts and tree nuts, fish and shellfish. Those tend to be a bit more persistent. And so that's where monitoring is really important, getting a baseline assessment with your allergist and knowing exactly where your child lies, because then they're able to give you really specific guidance on your child, whether it seems that they may outgrow it and might tolerate a food challenge in the office, or they might need to continue to strictly avoid it.
Because then how do you reintroduce those foods? It would have to be very carefully to see if there is, you know, a weakening of the allergy.
Right.
You just can't give them peanuts and hope it, well, let's see what happens.
If they've already had a reaction, you definitely do not want to try to reintroduce it at home. This is where guidance comes from the allergist, because there are specific testing that would occur to allow the physician to know whether or not it's even safe to consider reintroduction. And then if a consideration is made, then there's a really candid conversation of what this means, what could possibly happen, when this should happen, where it should happen, which is generally in the physician's office with all emergency medications in place. It's really important to have these, though, because we want to be able to introduce foods when we can. I mean, from a parent's perspective, it is so difficult to have to avoid foods and read every label and have fear that your child can have a reaction. It's difficult to eat out. It's difficult to know the difference between may contain or trace amounts or produced in a factory that has it, and really sorting these things out. So this is where that expertise comes in. And so I would encourage any parent that has any concern about food allergy to talk to a board certified allergist immunologist. We have great ones here to help sort that through.
And what's interesting is how the child learns it too. I have a nephew who has severe peanut allergies, and he was staying with me and I was going to offer him what I thought was something that was peanut free. He's only 4 years old, and he looked at me and he goes, "Aunt Gail, I don't think I can eat this." And I look at the back and there it said peanut oil. You know, I'm like, wow. So children are learning themselves how to cope with it, too.
They have to learn. I believe that it's so important that we empower parents with information, the child with information, the schools. The major things are really, in my mind, be aware and be prepared. And so it's important for the child to know.
This is an email from Julie. She questions, does it matter why you eat during pregnancy in regard to food allergies? Is it helpful, hurtful, or neither?
So that is a really great question. And we don't have a solid answer for that. Right now, we don't recommend limiting any food for a mom unless we know that there is an issue. And really, this comes up more when they're breastfeeding or after the delivery of the baby. But during pregnancy, we actually don't recommend limiting foods unless there's a clinical reason to do so for the mother herself. But that's a great question, and research is going into that very topic.
Can kids, we talked about kids growing out of food allergies. What about then as these kids grow up and they don't have an allergy, and all of a sudden as an adult, they have an onset of something that they never used to be allergic to, and all of a sudden they are?
Yeah, so that's where even less research has gone into. But we know as allergists that you can develop a food allergy at any point in your lifetime. So it doesn't have to be a childhood allergy. It can happen at any point. There is a lot of research going into food allergy in children, perhaps a little bit less than food allergy in adults, but so the mechanism is not so clear why someone might have tolerated a food for 50 years and all of a sudden they have this new fish allergy or new nut allergy, but it can certainly happen. So we say, you know, if you're concerned that there could be a reaction, even as an adult, get it checked out. It's important to know. Now, I will say, though, that adults tend to have more food intolerances than allergies.
And the difference?
The difference is that we call this an adverse reaction to a food. And under those adverse reactions, you can have true food allergy where you've got these immune antibodies that could cause you to potentially have anaphylaxis, the type of allergy that would that someone would need to carry an auto-injectable EpiPen or Avicu or one of the equivalents, or food intolerance. And intolerance is much broader. So many adults have issues with foods that might cause bloating, abdominal pain, diarrhea, headaches, nasal congestion, nausea. Joint aches, nausea, generally feeling unwell. Those fall into food intolerances, which have different mechanisms than food allergy. So clearly you don't need an EpiPen for them, but they still make you feel unwell. And we see that far more in adults, but adults can have true food allergy as well. So if there's ever a question, it's best to check.
None of that sounds fun either, what you call an allergy.
Yes.
Nothing fun.
Yes.
Is avoidance then the only strategy for dealing with allergies, or do you now have medicines that can allow folks to maybe eat things that they couldn't before?
That's also a wonderful question. So right now, the main strategy is avoidance. Mm-hmm. But we know that in the pipeline, there's several different therapies for food allergy, such as oral immunotherapy or epicutaneous, meaning with a patch immunotherapy to foods. They're in trial. None are currently FDA approved, but we expect to see some FDA approved products soon. Right now, the only strategy on the market, mm-hmm. I say in quotes, is avoidance. And so, and that's extremely important. But this is where the conversation comes in, because soon we're going to have some options that are widely available outside of clinical trials. And then a parent will need to know, does my child fit criteria for these options? Which is the best? And so this is where those conversations and that expertise is needed. So I always say, again, it's good to touch base with an allergist, find out what your child is allergic to, if they have allergies, develop a strategy, because that strategy certainly needs to be in place for caregivers, daycare, schools, et cetera. But also, too, to be able to be informed about upcoming treatments that might be available that may or may not be right for your child. So lots will come out. Many parents will be interested once these come out. And so knowing, is this right for me? Because everyone's immune system is very individual, it's going to be very important. That's where a lot of expertise will come in.
The EpiPen has proven to be life-saving.
Yes, absolutely.
And every child or every teacher, a lot of kids know how to do it themselves, or their teachers, if they're younger, have them. But there, at some point, there was that price that was just out of this world for the EpiPen. Where are we on that part? Is it available for people at a reasonable cost now?
So it still depends on your insurance plan, but we are seeing that it's available, or an EpiPen equivalent. So EpiPen is not the only auto-injectable epinephrine device on the market. So there are other ones on the market that might be better covered based on your plan. There are generic versions as well. So we're seeing that there are other options, but the main idea is that you just need to have the epinephrine and it needs to be available. And so having an EpiPen, but having it in your purse at home when a child is having a reaction at school doesn't help anyone. So having one that's immediately available and knowing how to use it are the most important things.
If you are raising a child, well, you are raising a child.
Yes.
Okay. Do you go with that theory that outside is better? Let me find those immunities. All the antibacterial things that people say are maybe not doing good things to our body, we're too clean. Do you believe that theory?
Well, you know, we know that some immune changes happen based on our exposures. We know this, that in some populations, which are more rural farming populations, there have been Amish studies that have looked at it and seen that without some of these common exposures we have, the amount of allergy is a lot less. So we know that there's something there. We don't have formal guidelines on exactly what to do. So parents really will make their own decision on whether I want to use hand sanitizer. I don't encourage anyone to go overboard.
Like anything else.
Yeah, not, I mean, so you kind of use caution. If you're in an area where you know that it's germy and you don't want your child to end up with an infection, it's reasonable to consider hand sanitizer. Do you need to use it 20 times a day? Maybe not. You know, so, but we don't have a solid answer for that. So we say use your best judgment, but we know that there is likely something there.
Dr. Princess Abagoo is the Director of Allergy and Immunology at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Wonderful conversation. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
And that's it for All Science today. I'm Gail Hogan. This is 89.7 NPR News.